This is Josie Brown with Author Provocateur. A pending divorce, an estranged child. Eden Miller, a 45-year-old realtor, finds her life crumbling, her heart broken, and her ego bruised until a chance glance at the Facebook page of her college crush has her sending him a friend request, which is answered. And so it begins, a passionate communication with the sexiest man she's ever known, who, it seems, is also soon to be single. Is it too good to be true? Best-selling author Samantha M. Bailey's latest thriller isn't just a roller coaster of passion and deception, but a deep dive into the psyche of a woman whose hope for a new start comes at a big price, one that may cost her everything. Samantha and I discuss how she concepted such a vulnerable protagonist, how she ratchets up the tension for Eden, and how Samantha has honed the reputation for delivering thrillers about women whose trusting natures allow others to infiltrate their world with the intent to destroy. Oh my God, I have so many questions for you about this book. I have to tell you, first of all, I love that your publisher is calling A Friend in the Dark a sensual thriller. It's a spot-on description because the book is so much more than a domestic thriller or a psychological thriller, though it embodies both of those descriptions as well. So, Sam, let's start with a confession. Did this book get more or less sensual while you were writing it?
Well, first, I actually want to go back to what you said. First, yes, my publisher has been amazing. My editors have been phenomenal in this, in the whole process, because it was a tricky process when it came to the sensual. To me, domestic suspense not should include the sensual, but I do think sensual and sex is part of relationships. And so, yes, I was very happy that they put that in the description. Did it become more sensual? Okay. Well, when I decided to go for it with this book, I stepped out of my comfort zone and thought, I'm going to take all the risks. I always do with every book, but this one in particular, I thought, I know the story I want to tell. I know the woman I want to write about. I knew to do that, I was going to have to push the envelope. And you know me, you've known me for 11, 12 years. I have no filter in my real life. I have a very naughty mind in real life. And so I laid it all out there on the page, like all out there. I just went for it more and more and more. And I, at that point, I didn't know where is the line. So where is the line that I have to be careful not to cross? Where is the line so it's not gratuitous? Where is the line so that it stays in the genre of domestic suspense? And thank goodness for my editor. Together, we found the line. And a lot of editing was done to massage those scenes to get them to where they needed to be. And by the time I was done, I was very, very happy with where the happy medium was.
Right, right. No, I was happy with your happy medium too, but I felt that that's what made this book so different, is that it was almost literary in the sense that when you take away a filter, that's when something becomes not necessarily genre. And I liked the fact that it took a step closer to what every author dreams of, is this will relate to somebody who not necessarily reads that genre, but they want a book that kind of sears their soul in a different way. So I felt good that you kind of crossed that line with this book. I mean, you always cross a line with every book, but this was a wonderful line for you to cross at this stage, I felt, of your career, having read you since you began.
So thank you. Oh, I'm going to have to now remember that. And when this recording comes out, I'm going to tape it and then I'm going to replay it all the time. Every book I write is different and it's the book I need to tell. You know, I'm working on my next book coming out in March 2025, The working title is Hello, Juliet. And it's very different from A Friend in the Dark in terms of the content. It is so important for me to live in that world that I'm writing and to put everything I've got into it, to put my whole soul, everything I have into it for the purpose of the story and for the purpose of what are the characters telling me to do. I didn't necessarily want Eden to make the choices that she was making. If I were her friend, you know, it would be different, but she had to. And I had to then just follow where she was going. But I feel proud that I did do something in the thriller genre that is still, you know, people aren't sure about sex in thrillers. There are people, and there are people who don't want sex in any of their books. And that's, oh my gosh, of course. And there's so much to choose from if that's not someone's thing when they're reading. It is very much my thing when I am reading.
Yeah, I hear you. It's mine too. I particularly like the way you kind of showed your audience the life that Eden Miller, who's your protagonist, and she's a Grosse Pointe realtor, you know, had, and that her life was crumbling at this particular very vulnerable age. She's 45 years old. On the day she and her emotionally distant husband drop off their only child, you know, their daughter Ava, at her college campus for her first day as a freshman, he asks for a divorce. This event was the driving force, I felt, of her fall from grace, her misperceptions of the past, and the truth, and her redemption. So, you know, like, how did she come to you? Did she come to you fully that vulnerable person, or did you go, I need this, I need that in her, or I know people like that. I know people who have hit that train wreck at a particular point in their life.
It was a culmination of so many things. The idea for the book came when I started thinking about how amazing it is that I and so many author friends have formed these incredibly deep online connections with people that we perhaps have never met in real life, that we may never have even seen face-to-face over Zoom. What we reveal to each other, the confidence is this connection, it's like no other. It is this sense of belonging, of being understood. And I thought, how fascinating is that? I think that's a result of the pandemic in many ways. I think it's a result of finding people who get you like no one else gets you. And then I started thinking, ooh, what if like one of these authors that I trust, you know, so deeply isn't quite as, you know, good as they seem to be. And then I thought, ooh, what kind of person, like where in someone's life would they be the most vulnerable? Where would someone be the most vulnerable, the loneliness, somebody who desperately wants to be wanted and desired and is feeling so undesirable and alone? And from there, who Eden was came to me instantly of someone who has always done everything right, only for it to all go so wrong. Someone who has not been reckless, except for a single night in her life. Someone who doesn't take risks because her job is to take care of her family, to be the one in control, to be the one who everyone else goes to for the advice. And she has a lot of shame deep inside her from how she grew up about sex and her own body and what it means to be a woman and what it means to be a mother and to separate that. And then, of course, like you asked, I definitely have a lot of female friends who, yes, going through separations, going through a divorce in their 40s, kids are, you know, becoming more independent. And these friends who are doing things that might be considered very, very risky, because it's almost like they're either reliving their youth or having their youth for the very first time.
Wow. Yeah, I've seen that in friends as well. You know, you look at them and you go, didn't you do that in your 20s or, you know, or in your late teens? But no, if they'd been married as long as Eden had, that may not have been their reality. So they're reliving a part of their life that they missed somehow, which I was really sad about. Besides her husband, she's also estranged from her daughter, Ava. Ava blames her mother for her parents' estrangement, even though Eden doesn't know why. I know that you're a parent of teens. Did you work out the miscues that Eden has in her attempt to reconcile Ava just by life experience or what you've seen with other parents and how maybe they are frustrated about their own relationships with their kids? How did that come to you? Because I know you've got a very good relationship with your kids. I envy how sweet they are with you. I remember the very first phone call I ever heard them talk to you, which was hilarious.
I think they were 3 and 6 at that time, and now they're 13 and 16. So, well, no matter how close we are to our kids, no matter how solid a relationship is, kids and parents, there are so many things we can't possibly see eye to eye on. So for sure, it was not based on my children. Ava is not based on my kids, not on my, daughter or my relationship. But a lot, I think, was based on how I saw myself as a teenager. And yes, what I see from other teenagers and just that feeling of, I know what I'm doing. How dare you tell me what to do? You are so much older and so much uncooler than I am. You have no idea what I'm going through. You have no idea what life is like now. So how can I possibly relate to you? And how can you possibly relate to me? And how can you not trust me to make decisions? So I think there's so much of that. And Ava and Eden are such different people. Eden was never like Ava. Ava racks up charges on their, card at Sephora. She takes bottles of their alcohol. She misses her curfew. Eden got a C and, it felt like the world had ended. They're such different people that for them to understand each other, they have to both understand the differences and appreciate the differences in each other, which takes a long time for them.
Right. It's funny to me as we go through the book, obviously, by the end, you see the love and the fact that the care that both of them have for each other was challenged and tested and comes out beautifully. I mean, you see the love that both of them have and why their subsequent actions bear that out. What they think is happening isn't really happening. So they try to make a new reality out of what's happening. And it turns out only then that they discover how much that they really care about each other. And I was very touched about that kind of child-parent
synchronicity.
Because sometimes it's during those hard moments that we find out the true love and metal that we have for a person, how far we'll go for that person. And as a parent myself, I know how far I would go. And I saw you in every portion of this book. So I thought that was admirably put together. I could see that moment as a parent doing exactly what she would have done. And, as a 16-year-old, knowing my own 16-year experience and my parents were also going through some stuff, I felt like, the way I talked to my mom was like, like I thought I was an adult. I wanted to get my feelings expressed.
And you think you're an adult and the world revolves around you. That's the other thing about being a teenager is, of course, they're good people and they're compassionate, but the world revolves around them. And even listen, the world revolves around us too, in our, now that I'm almost 51, it still revolves around me, but and my kids. As parents, and I know this, yes, from you as a mother, oh my gosh, I know your children are everything and we will protect them at all costs. And ultimately they know we are their safe landing. That really, no matter how they treat us and talk to us, whatever, we are going to be their safe landing.
Exactly. Exactly. They always come first. The book has a few flashbacks to Eden's first year in college. For any of us a decade or more older and removed from that time of our life, we learn that what we've perceived at the time may not have been the reality. This is certainly the case with Eden, whose presumptions of what went on that particular night when a dear friend goes missing. Let's discuss the perception that drives her to let down her guard with Justin. Her separation and grief has tempted her to kind of react to a former crush of hers who she met during her college freshman year, Justin Ahadi, who was with a local band. But there's a dark twist to how he comes back into her life, especially since he too is married. He informs Eden that he's separated and he's flirty at first, but then sexting comes into play, which gets Eden in trouble, both in her job and surreptitiously, and with her broken family. So let's talk about plotting, because it's not just Eden who's deceived, but you did a great job of deceiving the reader as well.
I don't know if I call it deceiving, because it's all through Eden's eyes. And I'm going to just go back. So it was her final year in college. It was her senior year in college. So senior year in college, she meets Justin when she and becomes his tutor. She helps him essay. So twice a week, she meets this hottie, as he called him, this absolute rock god. He's a drummer of a band. So not her type. Tattoos, long hair. Never before has she ever had that kind of physical reaction to anyone the first time she sees him. She is not someone led by her emotions. She is led by what her accomplishments are supposed to be. And it just undoes her. She becomes, you know, completely infatuated with him. And he's so charming. And with her, because she's helping him, he's vulnerable with her and he tells her things and they develop this bond. And she feels seen by him. You know, she feels pretty when she's with him and she wants to like dress up, but she doesn't know how. Her friends help her with like her outfit and her hair. And this is a part of her that she has never, experienced before, never explored before. And this guy invites her to a party. You know, Justin invites her to a party. And is it a date? Not a date? Does he want her? Does he not want her? Every single nuance, every conversation, every word, she's analyzing it in her mind because she wants him so much. She is a virgin. She has images of like losing her virginity to him. She just sees this guy. This is her all. It's all she can think about. We've all had, I think, that person in our lives who it really wouldn't matter what they do. We're so far gone, infatuated, that we can make up any excuse for any behavior because we're so far gone and we want them. And then she isn't with him that night for reasons, which you'd have to read the book. So when she's there on her 45th birthday and it's 6 weeks since Dave has asked for her divorce, her daughter is gone. She's alone in her big house, celebrating her birthday by herself because she doesn't want anyone to see her. She's embarrassed of who she is at this moment, that she actually doesn't know who she's supposed to be now. She's not a wife and a mother. And her friend tags her in a photo on Facebook with Justin in the photo and the same reaction. All these years later, she hasn't had a reaction like that to anyone, even Dave, because Dave is, you know, her safe place. It wasn't that wild, crazy, rip your clothes off feeling. It was comfort and security and love. And so that reaction, feeling something other than loneliness and pain and sadness and how pathetic she has felt, that is the driving force for everything that happens. Because that feeling, it is lust, it is longing, it is again infatuation, and it is the hope that someone wants you as much as you want them. And it is that hope that is dangled in front of her that makes her do things that never in her life did she think she would ever do. And it feels to her almost safe because it is happening online. He is not touching her. She is only touching herself.
Yeah. And to make matters worse, he too is separated. At least that's what she's told, or, you know, what's communicated to her. And that brings in his soon-to-be divorced wife, Olivia. And I love the fact that you had Olivia's point of view as your secondary character's point of view, because to me, she's the catalyst for events that happened in the past, in the present, and the future. And you've also made her a sympathetic character because you've pretty much, when you see things through her eyes, you see how what happened on that fateful night affected her as well. So when you were doing your plotting, did you know she would always be the catalyst, or did that come to you later?
So most of the plot remained the same from the beginning in terms of major events that occurred in the book. I knew those. I write very detailed outlines. And then much of it gets tossed out, you know, like the clues and the beats and just little things and things get moved around. But the major things stay the same. The premise stays the same. Generally, the twists stay the same, to answer that.
Right. You use it as a roadmap, but you go off-road.
Yeah, my characters force me off-road. They take the wheel.
I love that analogy. It's true. They grab the wheel. It's sort of very, you know, Thelma and Louise.
Right. Exactly. And they go over the cliff.
Right. Right. Well, Olivia goes over the cliff in a big way and takes everybody with her in a big way. But I also thought it was interesting how she internalized her need to clue in Eden in various ways. I really loved how you had empathy for all the characters you should have empathy for, and some of the characters that you would think, no, there's no empathy here. Everyone here had a reason to be who they were. I know it's hard to do that because people usually write light or dark. They don't see the chiaroscuro that's there, where it goes from light to dark and back to dark again. I felt that about each character. Each character had flaws, and the ones that you felt should have overcome them did overcome them. And I know in your process, it's not easy because you are writing thrillers and people expect bad guys to be bad guys or bad gals to be bad gals. But the reality is, if you don't make them empathetic to some extent, nobody will see their cross purpose. And that's what you were trying to do here. When you write characters, do you do any kind of character chart, or do you just let the plot decide what the character's going to do at the moment? But then you must go back, I assume, and look at, why did this character do this? What was the underlying reason for that? I'd love to hear your process on that, because you do have a wonderful way of making even people that are the darker people in your books empathetic.
So first, thank you. I think you are such a phenomenal writer because of your meticulous plotting, but it's your characters. It is your characters that always grab me. The ones that are supposed to be quote unquote the worst are usually the funniest and the ones that I feel the most tug of sympathy for. So thank you. That means so much to me. And it means so much to me because there's such a thing, you know, with likable or unlikable female characters. And I don't care. I don't care when I'm reading if someone's likable or unlikable. I just want to be compelled to follow their journey. Are they entertaining me? Great. When I'm writing, it's not that I'm trying to make someone unlikable or I'm trying to make them likable. I'm trying to make them real and who they are. Whether they may seem naive or make rash decisions, it is true to their character. And the same way I don't ever want to change one of my friends because they are who they are, I can't change who my characters are, but I do need to know why they are the way they are. And I know that must sound so strange because obviously we have the control of these characters, but we truly don't, because they become real people who, you know, make their decisions. But the motivation behind their actions. So what are the motivations? Yes. So I do intense psychological research. I talk to psychotherapists, psychologists, and I do tons of reading, like so much reading into the human psyche, into each type of person my character is and everything that makes them who they are. I do definitely look at their past, their childhoods. How were they raised? How were they raised? Where did they grow up? What kind of family did they grow up in? How does that influence who they are? How do they feel about themselves? Where's their self-esteem at? Where's their self-worth at? The lower your self-worth, the riskier the choices you're going to make, stupid or not. And someone whose self-worth is low, to me, that doesn't make someone unlikable. What it makes me want to do when I'm writing and when I'm reading is to watch that person's growth and to watch that person come into their own, stumble and fall, pick themselves up until ultimately they reach that point where they do know their own worth. So tons of research, and then things change. I'll realize that something doesn't work, or that something else will work better, or that I'm not getting across what it is I want to get across, or, you know, my editor will say, yeah, I'm not buying it, you know, which I love. Like, I love really tough editors, honest, tough editors who are direct, tell me like it is, and then I will go and I will rejig and figure things out a little bit different. And then I also have to reimagine that person. And when I reimagine that person, they then make different choices.
That is a spectacular mantra, beautiful mantra of how to look at your character and revisit your character in regard to how that person works within the plot. You know, I want to tell you how much I appreciated the fact that you had, even to the last page, a wonderful reveal, a reveal that every thriller needs to just pay off everything that came before it. For that reason alone, I hope people pick up the book. Samantha M. Bailey, thank you for dedicating this book to me. It meant the world to me. And I, even before I turned the first page and saw that, and it blew me away, is just that to enjoy a book as much as I did was sort of like the cherry on a beautiful sundae, on a beautiful sundae.
Thank you. I will then breathe in the fact that you are not biased in the least. And can I read the dedication?
Yes, I would love you to read the dedication.
Because this is to the group of women that you and I have traveled with for a week to a beach house every year. We did it for 10 years, 9 years.
And hopefully we'll do it for the next 10 as well.
Yes, and yes, we'll do it for the next 10 as well, next 20. So for my beach braves, Josie Brown, Eileen Gooch, Francine LaSala, Meredith Shore, Jen Tucker, Julie Valerie, through all the ups, downs, and in-betweens, it's always us.
Always and forever, girl. Always and forever.
And thank you for having me on your amazing show.
You can find Samantha M. Bailey's latest novel, A Friend in the Dark, in Amazon. This is Josie Brown with Author Provocateur.